Welcome to the Center for Lit Podcast Network. You're listening to How to Eat an Elephant, a little book club for large books. Have you ever cast your eyes across a shelf full of classics and been driven screaming from the room by 500-page monsters with thick spines and important names? Then this is the show for you. We're here to take on these scary books together, because how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Hello, my friends, and welcome back to How to Eat an Elephant. This is the book club that could, the little book club that could, even. How are we making it through this masterpiece? I mean, how long have we been doing this, for starters? This is a summary episode, right? So, like, let's look back a little bit. How long have we been doing this?
It's time to take stock of where we are and where we've been.
Haven't we been doing this for over a year?
Over a year, yeah. We're approaching, like, a year and a half, I think.
If you are still with us after a year and a half's worth of doing this, we salute you. And we are very grateful for your participation.
I see t-shirts. I think I can.
I think I can.
An elephant climbing up a hill.
Oh my gosh. Make it so. Yes. Okay, but using that analogy though of the little engine that could, or the little elephant that could, or in this case the giant elephant that might. I do think when you reach the point that we have reached in this novel, you're cresting the top of the mountain, and we're about to start whooshing down the other side, and I feel a sense of expectation and excitement rather than, oh my goodness, there's so much of this book left to go. Do you guys feel that way too?
So do I. I completely agree.
I have a question for you though, Megan. How does that image work with the analogy of eating?
Yeah. We're
the
hooshing.
Big elephant that might. Well, I have another image for you. Are you ready?
I don't know.
I'm on a roll. Okay, you know Roald Dahl's story, Matilda?
Yeah, I do.
I promise I'm going somewhere with this. There's a villain in that piece. Her name's the Trunchbull, and she has this big chocolate cake, and all the kids in the school, she's the principal of a school, and all the kids want her chocolate cake, and one kid steals a piece, and his punishment is to stand on a stage in front of the entire school and eat a cake bigger than him. One bite at a time. And by the end, he's like, the entire school is cheering for him. He's so sick and he's so fat and the cake is almost gone. And the whole school cheers for him each bite. And he eats the last bite and everybody stands on their chairs and they're like, yeah, Bruce Bogtrotter is his name. Bruce, yeah, Brucey, like that. And he takes the last bite and he passes out. And I think that's what we're going to do at the end of How to Eat an Elephant.
We're going to take the last bite and pass out.
Pass out of yep. bliss.
Yeah.
Oh, like out of sheer chocolate cake bliss. Laden bliss. Oh my goodness. Okay, so here's a question for all of you. Having now watched Russia slide into its wartime state, where everybody's abandoning all of their ancestral homes and stuff. Choose for me an ancestral home. Where would you choose to live? They're all vacant now. Oh. You can move right in.
Rostov's,
100%. Bokonski's, Bald Hills.
Bald Hills?
Ooh, oh, yeah.
Country estate for Emily.
Yep.
All right.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
But so, Megan, though, you said at first.
I did.
A Moscow downtown residence, right?
I know, but I think the reason I did that was because of the cheery atmosphere brought into the Rostov house by the Rostovs. And if I'm taking over for them, I don't know if I could keep that up.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to take over their lifestyle necessarily. The idea is just which of these grand homes would you want to live in?
Yeah, but I'd want to live with the Rostovs. I think I was actually more drawn to them than their house.
To the family.
Yeah, so if we're being material, I'd take Bald Hills too.
I don't want to live at Bald Hills. That sounds terrible.
Really? Where would you live?
Yeah, the Bokonski's going to be there.
They're well, no, we're taking over, remember?
Now you're not playing by the rules of your own question.
I was playing by your rules. Okay, fine. If it's just the dwelling and no one else is there, probably Bald Hills. I think Bald Hills is the best place.
So nobody would choose Pierre's many, many estates. That's interesting.
Well, we don't know anything about Pierre's many, many estates. We really haven't spent a lot of time there.
No, just there's a lot of them and they're wealthy, you know?
Well, yeah, he's very well. But again, I'm not taking over Pierre's life. I'm just moving into one of the residences. In that case, actually, and you guys will back me on the veracity of this, I will move into the little upstairs, super rich but small upstairs apartment where Pierre parties in the very first opening page.
Yeah. and stand in the window. I was thinking
of the little country cottage of the Rostov's uncle, where the hunt happens. Ooh,
I forgot about that place.
Oh, that's a warm, happy place.
A little remote, though.
True.
We like remote. We grew up remote. Maybe we should spend the rest of the episode talking about how we grew up remote.
Or there we could stories. Actually recap volume 3.
No, there's no reason to do that. We have so many stories. There was a bear in my kitchen, you guys. It's awesome. Okay.
That does technically make you Pierre.
It does. We've talked about this before.
We have a particular...
That makes your dad Pierre.
I am Pierre. Dad is not Pierre. Okay. Well, so Emily has done a really, really wonderful job of summarizing. I asked Emily, I said, hey, Emily, could you put together like a list of like questions or something? Because she's very detail oriented and good at this kind of thing. And she responded by giving me like a 3-page blow-by-blow summary of the entire volume and a list of interpretive questions.
My favorite part of Emily's, she just did yeoman's work for us and helping us review and writing a little summary. It was like reading somebody else's college notes of a lecture that you missed. It was like, here are the things she thought were important with no punctuation at times. And my favorite part was when she's reviewing Andre's scene in the hospital tent where he's like badly wounded and he's about to meet Anatole again. She goes, Andre, badly wounded. Doctor kisses him on the lips, period. Next thought.
That was an effective smooch. My favorite part was when Andre was looking at all the soldiers in the pond and he sees them as cannon fodder, C-A-N-O-N. In other words, these people will be immortalized in a great classic of the Western tradition.
I told you guys I wasn't thinking too hard.
Shouldn't have said that to us because we were looking for it.
I love it.
Now it's here.
Give her a hard time, but actually it was totally brilliant. And a lot of the questions we're going to deal with today come from Emily's fertile mind, and we love it.
So I'm gonna do a little address to all of you listeners here. If you somehow are joining us right now for the first time, this episode may not make a lot of sense to you. I encourage you to go back to the beginning.
Start over.
Start over at the beginning, because what we do in this show is a blow-by-blow discussion of each five chapters at a time. And so we're going to rely on having done that and avoid narrating a bunch of plot points. We'll bring some up as they pertain to the questions that we're going to discuss today. But I encourage you to jump in at the beginning and listen to the whole story, because my, what a story it has been.
Although I have to say, one of the reasons that we do these recap episodes is for someone who has read up to this point, but doesn't want to go back and listen to our catalog of episodes about it. So they're familiar with the plot, but they haven't heard us talk about it. This is a place where we will go back and kind of broad strokes talk about the main thematic thrust of the conversations that we've had thus far.
We'll tell you the big ideas that Tolstoy has been ruminating on and give you our interpretation of them succinctly.
So let's just start at the beginning. There's a unique aspect to this section, which is that Tolstoy opens the part with an essay about historical causes, which I think is really interesting. And he does it a handful of different ways. In part one, he speaks to an abundance of causes in history. Right, that you can't understand. Well, help me with this. It's that you can't understand it all the way down to the bottom, because every single individual thought, word, and deed is a part of the multiplicity of the causes that are directing world events. Am I right about that?
Yeah, kind of at the climactic point of that first essay to open volume 3 in part 1, he says it's just as likely that one Frenchman soldier's unwillingness to re-enlist for the army is as good a cause for what happened at Borodino or the invasion of Russia as Napoleon's own will.
Right.
And so he's saying that there's so many little causes that we can't pinpoint one. You have to take them all together.
Which, of course, he makes that point to say something quite different, which is that you can't actually, because your little brain is too teeny tiny, take them all together. And so you can't actually correctly interpret history.
Right. But the important distinction there is that is just a limitation of the human mind. It isn't that there's no meaning. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's just that we can't perceive it right because there's so much of it.
An abundance of meaning.
Yeah. He says at one point, the deeper we go in search of causes, the more of them we find. And the implication is you will always find more. There's more than you've ever thought of every time you go to think about it. But he's by no means saying, don't think about it then, it's hopeless. He's saying every time you go to assign a cause, you're probably right and there's more than you thought.
You're probably right and you're probably wrong.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really true. And he's going to change his tune, maybe in the sense of walking around the idea and talking about a different side of it and then walking around it again and talking about the next side of it. But he never really varies from the theme of tying down these historical meditations into the lives of his characters and pointing out how their personalities and their instinctive ways of looking at the world have to do with these theories of history, right?
Well, yeah, because in part two, the thrust of the essay is that this multiplicity of causes means that history or the unfolding of events in the future is fated. And so it makes me think of all the times that Pierre says it had to be so. I just am beginning to think that as much as Pierre needs to mature and grow up, he might be right in Tolstoy's eyes that there is a sense in which his actions are caused by a multiplicity of circumstances in his own life. And yeah, it had to be so. He had to marry Helene.
So, okay. So then his essay on part two, the historical meditation that opens part two, of which volume are we in at this
point? Yeah, volume three.
Volume three, part two, opens with an essay on the fatedness of history and how we interpret it backwards, which seems to tie in directly to what you were just saying, Emily. Like, this is Pierre talking, and he is the embodiment of Tolstoy's second essay, in that he's looking back on his life and making sense of it by issuing declarations of how it's all happening to him instead of him asserting himself on it. It's fated, right? So I guess a question that comes to mind here is this at all a nihilistic principle? As he's discussing history and the multiplicity of causes, we've gotten to two of them, right? Multiplicity of causes and the fatedness of it and how we interpret it backwards. There's a little bit of determinism that can be heard under here. Is it determinism, and why or why not, I guess?
Well, here's the first thing that comes to my mind. When you talk about Pierre interpreting his own history, he does. He engages in the flawed thinking that Tolstoy is pointing out here in one particular moment that comes to mind when he looks back at that moment where Natasha greets him in the street when he's disguised. And he, at the time, he isn't even thinking about her in that moment when she sees him and recognizes him. But later on, he recalls that moment. And Tolstoy tells us that now, remembering it, he sees it as poignant and full of sentiment. And he doesn't recognize the change in his thinking about that moment as he reflects on it. He has given it meaning looking back on it.
After the fact. Yeah.
So I wonder if that helps us think about the nihilistic aspect, because that's both a cynical thing to say on Tolstoy's part. However, thinking about Natasha is also what opens up Pierre's horizons. And we're told that when he thinks of Natasha's face, he no longer asks the questions why and what for. He brings him out of his little mind trap that he's put himself in, and he can just live. So it seems like even though this is the way that history goes, it's also productive in the human life in some way, that it's leading towards some good.
And I think that I see that theme in a couple other scenes as well. Like when Princess Maria is struggling with the death of her father, also in this volume, there's a line that says, "We can only weep when the present becomes past." And I think that Pierre's doing the same thing. He's not weeping in that scene where he recognizes significance when Natasha speaks to him, but he's looking from the perspective of the future back at the past and recognizing significance where he didn't notice it before. Doesn't mean it wasn't there, but he's noticing it now with a new perspective. And I think maybe Tolstoy is, again, tying that into the role of the historian, looking back at things that have happened already and it not being an entirely hopeless mission to try and find meaning there.
Right. I agree with you. I don't think it's a hopeless mission altogether. And partially because Tolstoy seems to be really kind to his character. He seems to love them.
Right.
And none of them can help doing this. I mean, I think Tolstoy looks at humanity and says, we're going to do this. This is how our brains work. This is how our hearts work. And I don't think he reviles humanity. So I don't think it's a negative principle that he's expounding. But it is fraught with danger. And we see it in Pierre all the time. There's this urge to define oneself.
To misappropriate some things.
Right. Exactly. Misappropriate some things. But mostly to assert yourself against a world that doesn't know who you are. Assert yourself against your own inability to know who you are and to just say, okay, well, I don't feel secure in my identity, in my instincts, in my habits. I'm pretty sure I'm a bad guy underneath all of this. And so I am going to make bold declarations about who I am and say them loudly enough and long enough to convince myself and the people around me. And I think Tolstoy sees the historians of the world doing that, some sort of cosmic national self-justification by asserting an interpretation of history loudly and longly.
Well, yeah, the negative example, like you're speaking of, is when Pierre reads his own past and says, ah, yes, because 666, because Pierre Bezuov, he doesn't even spell his name right.
Right.
Because of this, Napoleon is the Antichrist and I'm the one who's going to kill him.
Right. There's a ridiculous element to it for sure.
But I also, and I hadn't thought about this until just now, but early in the story, Pierre actually lionizes Napoleon, right? He thinks he's a genius. And in his youth, he thinks he's a genius. And I think the idea of sort of a quarter life crisis or maybe a midlife crisis having to do with looking back on the things of youth and defeating them to establish your wisdom and maturity and age, to establish that you have changed. I see a little bit of that in the way Pierre looks at Napoleon. It's not just the effects of the actual historical causes of Napoleon conquering Russia and proving himself to be kind of a megalomaniac. It's also Pierre looking at himself and looking at Napoleon through the lens of himself and reviling him himself.
Yeah, and the other difference between him looking backwards in 666 and looking backwards and seeing Natasha is that when he makes the decision about killing Napoleon, he is reading the past in order to decide what's going to happen in the future. Whereas in the case of Natasha, he's reading the past and nothing, right? He's just, it gives him life in the present. Mm-hmm. And it's when we start making assumptions about the future that Tolstoy seems to be saying we're in trouble.
So, okay, so how does this interact with a couple of the big historical moments that Tolstoy includes in the book? I mean, we have the Battle of Borodino, literal historical battle called the turning point of the war by a lot of people. We have the burning of Moscow. These are all these verifiable historical moments, and Tolstoy imbues them with significance. How do those moments interact with this principle?
Well, immediately my mind jumps to what you said a minute ago, Ian, that Tolstoy recognizes human beings can't help but do this thing where they look back at the past and they impose a meaning on it. And then maybe even, like you were saying, Emily, look forward to the future and say, knowing this, now we can assign causes to the future. Tolstoy identifies with his creatures as he talks about these historical moments. He even talks about them in French at one point. And I remember a conversation that we had where we recognized that French is the language of pretense in this novel. It's the language of the courts, where everyone is posturing and posing and trying to be somebody, trying to imbue themselves with significance, even in the moment. And when Tolstoy does address these historical moments, he does it in French, as if to say, I'm doing it too. See how I relate to you. See how this is just a human instinct. And he does a great summary of the facts of the moment, but there's a heavy interpretation in each of them. And I think that he's aware of that.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
I'm also thinking that the entire novel seems to center around the burning of Moscow. Like, I'm thinking, I know that Tolstoy didn't intend to write about these events. He was actually hoping to write about the revolution that comes after.
Yeah.
He just kept going further and further back and couldn't help himself. But
this happens to other authors too. Like, you have an idea for a story, but then it turns out the world building that comes along before it gets more interesting to you. So you end up writing a prequel to your original idea.
Right.
But it's obvious to everyone else that that's what you should have written in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And kind of subconsciously then what emerges is that Tolstoy is interested in the abandoning of Moscow and its burning. And so inasmuch as he is interested in Russian history and in the Russian identity, I think that is telling because I think it fits into the conversation that we're having about historical causes. This is the moment in Russian history where the people acted illogically for no good gosh darn reason.
It's counterintuitive.
It's counterintuitive. They leave their sacred city to be burned for, and everything is randomized and it just doesn't make any sense. And yet this potentially tragic moment is what allows them to win the war against Napoleon. And so this seems to fit exactly into the theory of history that Tolstoy is telling us, that it couldn't have been planned. It couldn't have been executed. However, living intuitively, just being carried along by the stream of life, the Russians, this is the most glorious Russian moment because their nature, which fits into the nature of the world, according to Tolstoy, is what saves them.
Their nature is what saves them. That's so interesting.
That's interesting. I can totally see that, and I really appreciate it. I hadn't thought of it that way. The way that I approached that thought of the burning of Moscow is that it's so counterintuitive. They left behind everything important to them instead of standing up for it. And as a result, they gained it in the end. They got Russia back in the end. And it seems to be like a... I know that Tolstoy probably wouldn't say this because it's too overtly Christian, but it's like a you must lose your life to gain it kind of a situation where they relinquish control and then it comes back to them. And as they relinquish control, they actually say out loud, God have mercy on us. So it's like they're throwing themselves on the mercy of this providence that also is an element of Tolstoy's conversation and causes. He keeps mentioning this providential force and they recognize him as they leave.
Yeah.
I think that's really beautiful. And I don't know that Tolstoy would disagree with you, because when I think about his other major thematic threads, the first thing I thought of was the repeated scenes of repentance and forgiveness that we get in this section. And the heart of forgiveness is relinquishing control over your right to justice, right? Repentance is relinquishing your own narrative and putting yourself at the mercy of someone else. And forgiveness is relinquishing your need for justice. And it's subservience in both cases. And that is also historically, that's the historical philosophy that Tolstoy is proposing to us as well, to relinquish our control because we don't have it anyway. So you might as well just
tell the truth,
live in tune with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell the truth. The other way that he tells the truth that I think sort of synthesizes all of this and is that growth and change come about through suffering, even positive growth and change, right? Like not just suffering will come to us all, you know, live in fear, but it's more like we see our characters becoming more themselves, becoming realer, becoming more lovable.
Less pretentious.
Yeah, less pretentious as they suffer. And I think that's happening on a national scale, not just a personal one. That's a principle of Tolstoy's world. Princess Maria says, misfortunes come from God and not from people. Do you guys think that that's actually borne out by the story? Is that something that you guys know my struggles taking Princess Maria seriously? Do you think that's a Mariaism?
Princess Maria.
I think she's I can't get along with
simpering.
Her. Simpering. Yeah. She simpers just a hair. But do you think she's right? And is she the voice of the author here or not?
I really struggle with this because on the one hand, I agree that the suffering is one of the tools in the hands of providence. And she's right in that first sentence. But when she says it comes from the hand of God and not from men, I struggle with that second part because that seems to take away the responsibility of individuals for the suffering that they cause. Like that seems to get Andre off the hook, for example. So I don't actually know how I feel about this.
Well, I agree. It seems to me that Princess Maria is a limited character. She's got a piece of it, but not all of it. She's right and wrong at the same time. She's a quintessential Tolstoy character. It might be a multiplicity of causes in that moment as well. And I'm thinking of Rostopchin and what's his name? Verestchagin or something. It's impossible to let Rostopchin off the hook as he is absolutely responsible for the death of that man, and we watch him be ripped apart by the mob. Rostopchin did that, and he did it on purpose, and he knows it. So there is a, there has to be a sense of responsibility for the man as well. I think it needs to be, God allows this, and also we are responsible for the choices that we make. It has to be both.
Because confronting your own responsibility is part of the suffering that you have to undergo, right? Andre has to look up and say, oh, what I did to Natasha is unforgivable. I caused this needless suffering, yep. And it was wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's only when he does that that he's able to turn around and offer her forgiveness and reconcile with her.
I agree with that. I think you're right. I think that cuts through the BS. Cuts through the BS a little bit of Maria's perspective. I also think that where we left Princess Maria is indicative of, like Megan said, her being a limited character. Because who does she end up head over heels for?
Nikolai.
It's Nikolai Rostov, isn't it? Like, if we're supposed to be pleased for them, then we kind of think about them in the same category, which is as not so swift, maybe. Very sweet. Very sweet and
Ian's
and
feeling
loyal,
so justified.
But not so swift. I think that might be maybe we're seeing in Princess Maria's character the early movements of Tolstoy's later disaffection with organized religion. So anyway, I don't know. That may be too much to say, but
however, the end of Andre's arc in this section is that he does end up saying, put the gospels under me. This is what I've come to. The truth that I see in the world now is what my sister has been trying to teach me all along. I see it.
Yeah.
And we see it too as readers.
It hitches together, to use another buzzword.
Oh,
right?
That phrase. I still don't understand that phrase.
Well, I want to talk about it a little bit. But first, I want to talk about Natasha. She hasn't come up very much yet. And when I think of growth via suffering, I mean, obviously Andre, as you guys immediately jumped to, but Natasha comes to mind for me because what a hard story this has been to read, to watch in Natasha. She opens the story as a little girl. She's not a grown up. And to some extent, all the things that happened to her as a child until very recently. And so you get to watch this suffering grow her up, and you can see Tolstoy, you can see Tolstoy's compassion over humanity. The only way to become a grown-up is to suffer. And so anyway, how do you guys see Natasha's growth happening? And what do you think of her now, here at this moment?
Well, I think of the significance of her coming to repentance, that she is, after she has been found out in her would-be affair with Anatole, she's devastated, she's ill, she becomes physically ill, and the doctors can't help her except by promising some kind of moral cure, right? They're helpful to her parents, really, as they come and pretend that they're doing something. But really, the problem is more spiritual in her heart. And the cure that she finds, or at least the medicine, is repentance, like Emily was saying a minute ago, this recognition of her own self and giving up of her narrative and admitting, this was not so romantic, it was actually a huge flaw in me. And she becomes well again as a result of repentance. But then from that moment on, she's walking with a limp. She's not cured all the way because she hasn't been forgiven. And I think that's so significant. It's the suffering that continues in her life. She is repentant. She longs for a moment where she can get on her knees in front of Prince Andre and beg him to forgive her. But that's delayed, right? And that's the suffering that's maturing her in this whole volume. It seems she's forced to sit in the knowledge of herself without resolution.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really, really well put. The that repentance and forgiveness are actually two movements in the story,
yeah.
And it's not complete until both of them have taken place.
Yeah, and as I was thinking about just what forgiveness is in the story, it seems to me to be supernatural in some ways. It's a gift that comes about in a moment where the character's having divine revelation. There's the scene with the comet where God comes down and is close, and Pierre looks up in a moment of love and reflection and acknowledges there's something higher here. He sees Natasha in such a loving way in that scene where the comet comes down. It's like a divine revelation that gives him an overflow of love. And we see the same thing when Andre is having his weird moment because he's, you know, he's dying, but he's having this strange, trippy moment. And that's when Natasha comes in and he does, in fact, forgive her. But it seems to be, again, an outpouring of a divine revelation. So forgiveness might be something that's beyond our power to hark up.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, it's, you talked a lot when we were talking about the comment in the last volume about that being a piercing of the veil between the divine and the human. And I think that's also embodied on a lower level by forgiveness, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah. Which makes me think, like, Megan, you mentioned love and these overflows of love before. I haven't seen a romantic relationship in this story yet that isn't deeply flawed and unsatisfying.
Yeah.
We've seen brotherly love succeed, and arguably that thus far, that's all Pierre has in his heart towards Natasha is a pure love that's unsullied by physical desire and is frankly not romantic. Maybe I'm misreading that, and you guys can go to bat against me if you'd like, but I guess what I'm thinking is that Tolstoy hasn't yet dug super deeply into romantic love in its more permanent form. What do you guys think of that?
I agree with you that Pierre hasn't made it all the way there yet. I think he does love Natasha truly, but at first it was brotherly and then it was immature, right? He considers her too far out of his league to even consider.
Right.
And even now it's still kind of chivalric, right? She is a symbol of goodness that calls him out of himself.
It's aloof a little bit.
Yeah, it's aloof. It's not...
She's aloof?
Well, I don't think she's aloof because he does see her in all of her messiness.
She's off limits.
She's off limits. Yeah. There's not...
It's knightly.
...fulfillment in that love yet.
So what sort of... I guess I'm just going to say the word love and then say disgust. I mean, like, what do you think Tolstoy has been saying thus far about love? What are its contours? How do you grab a hold of it? Can you grab a hold of it? Or is it a miracle? What is its impact? I mean, clearly this idea is on his mind. How so?
Hmm. Well, I immediately think of the phrase that Emily hates, hitching together. Well, maybe hates is too strong, but the one that sticks in your craw. Love seems to be the power that hitches people together in the story. And I think that it's happening in the relational level, that characters are trying to come together and hold fast to one another in the sea of causes. And it's happening at a bird's eye view level. Historically, Tolstoy is trying to look back and hitch things together with some kind of relational cause in each circumstance. And love seems to be the motive force in that project.
So would you say then on the historical level, it's the Russians' love for their own country? That we see that become catching in so many points. Pierre on the battlefield is infected by the patriotism of these soldiers, and Andre is infected by this as well. So is it the love of country? And if that's the case, why are the French lacking that?
That is a really great question.
That's so fun to think about. Well, the Frenchman that we get to have a long conversation about love with
Ramal,
right? And he's just, I mean, he, you know, he loves love, but I think his definition of it is really shallow and kind of twisted. And I don't know. I don't know if that's a cultural commentary from Tolstoy on Frenchmen in general. If so, I think that's not so nice.
I fear it may be. Right. I fear it may be. Well, I mean, he has been using Frenchness generally as a symbol for insincerity and posturing the entire novel.
Or is it a product of their imperial concerns that they are trying to take over land that isn't theirs?
Well, I think, yeah, that's unavoidably the cause of it. I guess I'm just saying, be the cause what it may, Tolstoy doesn't like Frenchies.
Right. Yeah.
But I do think it's interesting, though, that the most... The most salacious description of love we get from a Frenchman. There are some villains on the Russian side of the ball where love is concerned. Anatole jumps to mind.
Yeah, but Anatole. And also young Pierre, let's be honest. He's just total womanizer. He's
a little bit of a playboy, that's for sure. But he lays it on very, very thick in the Rambal scene. So
the Frenchman does have it right, though. He does say at one point that love is everything. Love is the essence. The essence is love. And I think Tolstoy would agree. I think you just might define it differently.
So I guess give me a sentence or couple sentence long description of what you think lies ahead, not plot wise, but character development wise for each of our most important characters. And I'm going to limit us because we are short on time here at the end of our episode. I'm going to limit us to Natasha, Pierre, and Andre. What is coming? Do they have much to learn? Are their arcs nearing an end? Give me a status report on our characters. In a second here, I'm gonna just go all teacher on everybody and say, Emily, tell me about Natasha.
Well, she has just received forgiveness from Andre, and they've been reconciled. Although the prognosis for Andre doesn't look great.
Bleak.
He seems to be nearing his end. And so, on the one hand, there's a certain fulfillment in their forgiveness that they've exchanged, and that is going well. But now we're about to see, I imagine we're about to see what happens when the object of one's love is removed. Mm-hmm. And the love is existent, it's real, but just like Pierre, it is no longer physically
available.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking more, it's taken me a minute, but Ian, you said, what's the definition of love in this volume? And it seems to me that you've got the concept of swarm life, everybody lost in a multiplicity. Everyone is important, but no one is all at the same time. And love seems to be closeness. It's being recognized by someone as unique in the midst of that swarm, seen in all of your ugliness and accepted anyway. And the solace in that moment is the physical presence of that other person who validates you, who says, I see you and I choose you in spite of all of these things, and you are significant to me. And I am curious to see what happens to Natasha now that she's finally gotten the forgiveness part of her journey. And I don't know if he's long for this world. I don't know that comfort will last. The solace of his physical presence might not be ultimately the solution for her.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. Also, I want to talk about Andre. Because I think he's one of my favorite characters thus far. I really identify with the struggles that he's been going through, and it's been really fun to watch him. But along those same lines, I think Andre is close to the end, because I think he has actually grown in all of the ways that we want each of our characters to grow. He has diminished in his own eyes. He has begun to see his primary role to the world around him as dispensing forgiveness in a totally selfless way. And I'm that's the whole thing is an encouragement to read because of that. Maybe, I mean, it took a mortal wound on the battlefield, I suppose, to get him to where he is now. But he has arrived at the place that I think Tolstoy is trying to point all of us to, which is, hey, we are here in the world too. Like you said, Megan, see one another and forgive one another. That's why you're here. So go about doing that. Mm-hmm. I hope we get to watch Pierre get there too. Emily, maybe that's where you were going.
Well, I just wonder if it isn't a coincidence that these revelations are coming as a result of a mortal wound.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've talked in the past about the fact that it's when death enters the conversation that everything begins to become more clear and take shape in the characters' minds.
You must lose your life to find it. There it comes again.
Well, yeah, I think mortality is actually a prerequisite for the kind of love that we're looking for.
Well, mortality is a prerequisite to any kind of growth, actually, because immortal things don't change. I mean, this is a Tolkien principle. He writes about it all the time.
Well, that's beautiful.
And I think that's really powerful here, that you have to actually be growing in order to love one another. But growing is the same as aging. And aging leads to death. And then also, I think when you look at Pierre, you see this confusion. And I think all the characters struggle with it. They're just not all as conscious of it as Pierre is. This confusion about whether your flaws are mortal wounds or not. Like, maybe this will heal if I could just find the right formula, right? If I could engender the right habits in myself, if I could work hard enough against these things, maybe I can actually change.
I could end my suffering, right?
Yeah, I could end the suffering of being the way that I am by changing myself. And Pierre tries and tries and tries and tries and tries again. And he fails every single time because because sin is a mortal wound, actually. Mm. And so I think you're right, Emily, to notice that mortality is at the heart of it. Andre is dying now. And so change is impossible. And so forgiveness happens. Mm.
I'm thinking about Pierre, because one of the questions we were supposed to think about today was, what does Pierre still have to learn? And I think that he wants the suffering to end really badly, like you were saying, Ian. He wants the way that he is to change as quickly as possible. He is down for the change, man. As long as he can make this awkwardness and wrongness in himself end. And he's even gotten so far as to say, sacrifice. That's what will do it. What we need to do is sacrifice ourselves. So what can I do to sacrifice myself? But he's distracted by the political situation with Napoleon. He thinks he's going to lay down his life for some kind of political cause and make himself a hero. And I don't know that that's the right kind of sacrifice. I think sacrifice might be close to the answer. Sacrifice of self somehow. But I think he's, even so, moving in the wrong direction.
Well, it seems like he's doing it with a view to his own glory in the meantime. Like, I'm going to sacrifice myself by slaying the most powerful man in Europe. Right? Like, you might not be as important as all that, is what it really comes down to. You might not be as important as all that.
Which is why I think it's critical that he's a prisoner now.
Yeah.
When you're a prisoner, you don't actually have control over your own actions.
Yeah.
So the experience of being forced into the obedience of his captors and the suffering that that will entail is probably going to be really good for him.
Oh, I think that's really true. And I think this is where Tolstoy, even if he does later in life say organized religion, poo-poo, he still is talking about true things and some very Christian ones. I mean, I think the relief that comes from realizing you are a prisoner is right at the heart of what the gospel talks about. Well,
that image is used, right? Prisoners
for Christ. Slaves to Christ. Yeah, slaves to Christ. You are bound. And that is good. Because if you're unbound, if you are really and truly free in every particular, look at the destruction that you are going to wreak on yourself and on the people around you. No habits can protect you or your people from your sin. It's a mortal wound. And so the message of safety in bondage to Jesus, I think, runs along at the bottom of this, whether Tolstoy wills it to or not. Hmm.
One question I wanted to ask you guys, kind of looking more at a bird's eye view of this novel, is to step back. I want to step back and think about the structure of it. I think that this volume is different in some ways than the other volumes we've encountered. It's a little more varied in the styles that Tolstoy's choosing. He's experimenting, with asserting his own voice in essay form. He experiments by that one scene where he parallels his own narration with the narration of a historical text and kind of interacts with it. The moment you mentioned, Megan, where he speaks to us for the first time in French, it's kind of modern and experimental in some ways that the first two volumes sort of played with, but not really. Do you guys think that this, what he's doing here, is effective, or is he losing control of his material in some ways?
It's a great question. I don't know that I have a good answer for it. I thought personally that it was effective. It felt to me like Tolstoy patterning a man trying to fuse together a lot of causes, trying to hitch together
history. You can't say fuse. You have to say.
Sorry. Well, it felt like this volume of all of the volumes is the meat of his effort, his artistic effort. And so we get to be led into his process. He's matching up historical documents and interacting with them. He's given you three different versions of him, his best guess about causes as historical philosophy.
He drew us a map.
Yeah, he drew us a map. Maybe that would help to look at a picture. I don't know. But he shows us in as many ways as he can think of what it looks like to be down in the weeds wrestling with this question.
Hmm. Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. I think that's really sharp. I would layer in, not on top of, maybe beneath, maybe off to one side. I would say that we know that Tolstoy rejects War and Peace himself, that his own understanding of art and what it's for, by his own, in light of his own understanding, yes, of what art is for, War and Peace fails the standard. And I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if this part is what does that. I think he he's aiming for very, very big game here. And it is effective to the reader in that it proves the foibles and weaknesses of human nature that he is trying to point out. I'm not sure he intended to point them out in himself. I'm not sure we can go so far as to say he sets out on a failed venture here for the purpose of making his thematic point clear. Right. I doubt that that's true.
No, I'm sure.
But I do think that's the effect of the part from my perspective, is to make it obvious. He becomes sort of a Pierre.
That being said, though, there are three sections that are like, they're like essays on his philosophy of history. And the last one's really scientific. It reminded me a little bit of the Moby Dick cetology chapters.
I was literally just going to say that.
Were you really?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. Well, the cetology chapters, they're very scientific also, but they are descriptions of if the whale is like God, they're descriptions of what you can know about God. And you can never piece them all together and say, finally, here's who he is, full stop. But you can piece together parts, and there's an infinite knowableness about the nature of God in Moby Dick. And this seems to be a similar approach to a big question. There's an infinite knowableness about causes and about the nature of this providential force. If you look, you can see it all through the world, all through the natural world. There's all kinds of evidence about who God is, but we still can't make a full stop summary of his nature.
Yeah. Well, and I think we get ourselves in trouble sometimes by saying that one of the things about God is that he is unknowable fundamentally, because that is a direct contradiction of the witness of the scriptures. The Lord says, I am knowable. Look, I will descend to earth, take on flesh for the sake of being knowable. And that doesn't mean that our finitude is capable of encompassing infinitude, but that's not the point. The point is God is knowable because he, in a positive way and not a negative way, the way Ahab means it, he does put forth his features from behind the pasteboard mask. He does actually say, look, here I am in this moment of forgiveness. Look, here I am in this moment of repentance. Look, here I am in this moment of self-knowledge. What is it, Martin the Cobbler, where this guy receives people as they're coming to his house, right? And each of those is revealed to have been a visitation by the divine. I think of a lot of scenes in War and Peace that way as well. It's probably the Russian-ness, if we're really honest. But, but I do. I think about scenes in War and Peace that way as well. Like classist. There's this moment where I look up and as I'm reading and I think, oh, this is Tolstoy saying God is like this maybe. And then the next a couple chapters later, oh, this is Tolstoy saying God is like this maybe. And it's really interesting.
But Emily, what did you think? That was a great question on the structure and the narration, and you asked us if it was jarring, and I guess I say no, but what do you think?
I agree with everything that you guys are saying. I think that it is ultimately effective to leading us towards the conversations he wants us to be having. I do think the experience of it can be jarring.
Word.
but I think that's what he wants. I think he wants us to be jarred.
You think it's craft?
Oh, yes. Well, it's certainly craft. My question was whether it was
effective. Is it effective? Yeah.
And I think it is. I think he wants us to be confused for the purpose of recognizing that our patterns of thinking about history and our own pasts are wrong.
Hmm.
Yeah, I do think, though, I agree with you, to acknowledge that this part's not super readable might also be helpful for our listeners. That this, in terms of smooth narrative style, this one gets pretty choppy, actually.
It is pretty choppy. When I was taking notes on what happened, it took like 5 pages. It's very dense, mm-hmm. and there's not much of a plot arc. Mm-hmm. Our characters actually don't move very much from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, no, it's really true. I mean, we get like, what, a grand total of 3 days of Natasha's life or something in this whole part? Like, it's crazy, man.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Well, you guys, thank you so much for your insights. I'm so excited to, as Megan put it, whoosh down the other side of this mountain.
Yeah, like a giant elephant lumbering down the other side.
Well, thank you, all you listeners, for being members of our giant elephant. Let us all swoosh down this mountain together.
I love where that went.
Yep, thank you. I thought so too. Until we meet again, friends, for our embarkment upon the final section. Right?
This is it. I imagine we might take a couple weeks off, gather ourselves, and then forge ahead into volume 4.
So excited. Well, as always, please jump into the Facebook group. We will see you there. And until next time, bon appetit.
Bon appetit.
Want to follow along with our reading? You can find a link to the schedule in the show notes for this episode. How to Eat an Elephant is a part of the Center for Lit podcast network. Visit our website at www.centerforlit.com to find our other literary shows, resources, and our membership program, the Pelican Society, where you can get access to a variety of live discussion groups. You can also find us on most social media channels. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, happy reading!